11. Winging It. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson worked to advance the U.S. relationship with India throughout the first year of the Trump administration. The South Asian Republic, the world's most populous democracy and one of its fastest-growing economies, was a natural ally to the United States. Tillerson felt strongly that America needed to fortify its alliances and block rivals, chief among them China, from taking advantage of any gaps or friction between the United States and its strategic partners. To that end, he believed that if the United States strengthened its Trans-Pacific alliance with India, Japan, and Australia with open trade and shipping routes, it could keep China at bay. In October 2017, Tillerson telegraphed the administration's hopes for the region and India in a speech at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and then jetted to New Delhi to discuss the alliance in person with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Tillerson was immediately impressed by Modi. The Prime Minister was a serious person, an experienced dealmaker who was motivated by the prospects of a strategic partnership with the United States. Modi was candid with Tillerson about his challenges. He was operating in a tough neighborhood. On one border was Pakistan, India's greatest threat, and on another was China, which had been trying to partner with Pakistan. To the north was Afghanistan, which was ravaged by war, highly unstable, and vulnerable to Russia and other countries. As he considered allies for India, Modi had options. He was inclined to deal with the United States, but if things ever went sour, Russia was knocking on his door. The second week of November, President Trump took his first trip to Asia, a five-country, 10-day journey that concluded in the Philippines, where he attended a global summit of leaders. On November 13th, Trump sat down with Modi in Manila on the sidelines of the summit. Tillerson had high hopes for the meeting, even though, back at the White House, Trump was known to have affected an Indian accent to imitate Modi, a sign of disrespect for the prime minister. As with most of his foreign leader meetings, Trump had been briefed but didn't appear to have retained the material and instead tried to wing it. He took a hard right turn into a nitpicky complaint about trade imbalances. Modi tried to refocus on the threats India faced from Afghanistan, China, and Pakistan. His mention of Afghanistan led Trump off into a lengthy tangent about how stupid it had been for the United States to maintain its military presence in Afghanistan for so many years. When Modi mentioned his concern about China's ambitions and aggression in the region, Trump revealed a stunning ignorance about geography.
"It's not like you've got China on your border," Trump said,
seeming to dismiss the threat to India. Modi's eyes bulged out in surprise. Aides noticed him giving a sidelong glance at Tillerson, who accompanied Trump as part of the U.S. delegation. The Indian Prime Minister considered Tillerson among the best-versed Americans on the region's security challenges, and together they had been plotting a new partnership. Tillerson's eyes flashed open wide at Trump's comment, but he quickly put his hand to his brow, appearing to the Indian delegation to attempt not to offend the president, as well as to signal to Modi that he knew this statement was nuts. Trump did not appear to notice their silent exchange. He just kept rolling, droning on about unrelated topics. Modi tried to keep the conversation on an elevated plane, hoping to follow the path Tillerson had laid out for them in the previous weeks to work together to protect India and fend off China's Belt and Road Initiative. But each time Modi tried to get Trump to engage on the substance of U.S.-India relations, the American president veered off on another non sequitur about trade deficits and the endless war in Afghanistan. Those who witnessed the meeting that day in Manila were disheartened. Modi's expression gradually shifted from shock and concern to resignation.
I think he left that meeting and said, "This is not a serious man. I cannot count on this man as a partner," one Trump aide recalled. After that meeting, the Indians took a step back in their diplomatic relations with the United States. The meeting with Modi was a major setback not only for U.S.-India relations, but also for the administration's hopes of checkmating China in the region. The meeting came at a time when Tillerson's influence with Trump was growing, simply because the president had tired of others in his orbit. In preparation for the Asia trip, John Kelly asked Tillerson if he could add another duty to his already full portfolio. Could he give Trump his national security briefings on the road? This request was odd. Briefing the president was normally the responsibility of the national security advisor. Tillerson asked Kelly why.
"He doesn't want to see McMaster," Kelly responded.
The signs of Trump's fraying patience for H.R. McMaster had been painfully obvious throughout the fall. McMaster's loyal staff hated to admit it, but they knew this relationship was no longer working. A military intellectual and policy maestro, McMaster was widely respected in Washington's foreign policy establishment and on Capitol Hill, but he did not easily fit into Trump's orbit. This much was evident right away. In his first town hall meeting of the National Security Council staff after being appointed in February 2017, McMaster emphasized that as a nonpartisan Army officer, he did not vote. He wanted the professional staff to know that he valued their input, but his admonition about voting unwittingly sent a message to Trump, who demanded political loyalty from everyone in his administration. McMaster lived by paperwork and process. He believed his duty was to give the president information so that he could make the best decisions, and then to help carry out the commander-in-chief's will. But his briefings to Trump were academic and detail-oriented, and the two men's stylistic differences inspired epic clashes. McMaster had difficulty holding the president's attention. Trump, meanwhile, would get annoyed with what he considered McMaster's lecturing style. The president felt his national security advisor was always determined to try to teach me something. Indeed, Trump constantly shifted and grumbled when staff were trying to bring him up to speed on a topic, immediately threatened by the notion that his knowledge wasn't sufficient if he needed experts. As the president repeatedly told Kelly when he proposed a subject briefing, "I don't want to talk to anyone. I know more than they do. I know better than anybody else." McMaster came across as a tank commander in his bearing and didn't seem able to change gears to the far more politically cautious mode of White House hedging and dodging. He had a barking kind of voice, which had reliably conveyed strength and directness in his previous world. But it proved to be a pitch Trump disliked instantly, as if it were a piercing dog whistle. Some mornings, Trump would come down to the Oval Office and see the president's daily brief on his schedule, followed by a meeting with the National Security Advisor, and complain.
"I'm not fucking doing that," he told aides. "I'm not talking with McMaster for an hour. Are you kidding me?"
Instead, the president would step into his private dining room, turn on the television, and summon National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, or Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to come over and keep him company. In March, McMaster was in the Oval Office briefing Trump on the visit of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, a favorite foil for the president. Trump got so impatient that he stood up and walked into an adjoining bathroom, left the door ajar, and instructed McMaster to raise his voice and keep talking.
It was unclear if the strange scene was a reflection of Trump's feelings about McMaster or Markle or both. McMaster felt it was his duty to speak truth to his commander, to notify the president of critically important issues, and even to highlight bad news and the cons of a particular strategy Trump was considering. That's how McMaster had always spoken to his wartime commanders when he was reporting from the battlefield. "Things have gone to hell, sir. Here's how bad it is." But Trump's intelligence briefers downplayed or withheld new developments regarding Russia's election interference or cyber intrusions so as not to agitate the commander-in-chief. When they left a key piece of information out of the verbal president's daily brief, McMaster would later raise it directly with Trump, only to become a punching bag for the president when he inevitably blew up. The routine frustrated McMaster. Part of McMaster's process entailed providing Trump with written briefing documents on each big decision, with detailed descriptions of the risks and possible rewards. He had tried to be concise from the get-go, boiling the material down to 3 pages, but McMaster and his team almost immediately realized the president wasn't reading any of the briefing books, or even the concise 3-page version. Staff Secretary Rob Porter would synthesize the memos in a 1-page cover letter, written in prose the president might find easier to digest. As one of Trump's confidants said, "I call the president the 2-minute man. The president has patience for a 30-page. But McMaster understandably resented the fact that Trump was reading Porter's version of Cliff's notes. Porter and Reince Priebus suggested an alternative approach. McMaster could deliver verbal briefings to Trump, nothing in writing. "Everyone agreed we needed to stop giving the president paper to read," one former National Security Council staffer recalled. HR was uncomfortable with this. McMaster kept saying, "How are we not going to give the president any papers?" McMaster and his deputies were mindful of history and fearful of failing to document a risk or of missing an important alarm. President George W. Bush had faced withering criticism when it was discovered that in the summer of 2001, he had been briefed on intelligence suggesting Osama bin Laden planned to orchestrate terror attacks using airplanes. Bush had actually received briefing books on this, but the intelligence did not prompt any corrective action. Eliminating briefing books for the president seemed to tempt disaster. McMaster came up with yet another plan that the staff put into full effect in September: note cards with bulleted factoids. Other top officials in the White House saw McMaster and some of his top deputies as overly suspicious. They fretted about the National Security Advisor's standing with the president and fought at times with others in the building, including Keith Kellogg, another Army lieutenant general who served as the chief of staff on the NSC but was loyal to Trump above all. By the time of the November trip to Asia, Trump was openly mocking McMaster. When McMaster arrived in his office for a briefing, Trump would puff up his chest, sit up straight in his chair, and fake shout like a boot camp drill sergeant. In his play, he pretended to be McMaster. "I'm your National Security Advisor, General McMaster, sir," Trump would say, trying to amuse the others in the room. "I'm here to give you your briefing, sir." Then Trump would ridicule McMaster further by describing the topic of the day and deploying a series of large, complex phrases to indicate how boring McMaster's briefing was going to be. The National Security Council staff were deeply disturbed by Trump's treatment of their boss. "The president doesn't fire people," said one of McMaster's aides. "He just tortures them until they're willing to quit." The cruelty also was uncomfortable for Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, Kelly, and other advisors to watch. Kelly was weary of McMaster's inability to take the hint that Trump was done listening. One day in the fall, Trump was meeting with a group of his advisors in the Oval Office, and Kelly decided the president was growing more obstinate on an issue, and it was time for the gathering to break up. "Thank you very much," Kelly said. "Everyone can leave now." McMaster moved closer to the resolute desk and said, "Mr. President, I'd like to keep talking to you. I have a few more things." Kelly did not take kindly to McMaster disobeying his order. The chief of staff stood nose to nose with the national security advisor and decreed, "I said the meeting was over." Here was a 4-star Marine general and a 3-star Army general nearly coming to blows in front of the President of the United States. Trump loved it, later telling another advisor that he was impressed by Kelly's willingness to confront McMaster and the sheer machismo he exuded. "This guy is an animal," the president remarked, complimenting Kelly. That the president's narrow bandwidth might have been the root cause of the disagreement didn't seem to cross his mind. On the Asia trip, both Tillerson and McMaster hopped into the president's vehicle in succession to give Trump his morning update before the motorcade took off for its appointed meetings. But as McMaster spoke, Trump frowned, turned his back, and interrupted him mid-sentence to ask Tillerson a question. It was a not very gentle cue for Tillerson to take over the role of updating the president on the key facts he needed to know. Tillerson engaged in a little small talk, then returned to tee up the debates Trump would tackle in his meetings that day. "As HR was saying, Mr. President," Tillerson began, a sign of respect and deference to the national security advisor at an otherwise painful moment. Tillerson didn't always agree with McMaster on style or process, but he told aides the man was selfless and dedicated to the mission. McMaster had occasional disagreements with Trump, such as over the long-term strategy in Afghanistan and the Iran nuclear agreement. Unlike several other senior advisors, though, he genuinely tried to help implement the president's wishes. Rather than impose his own agenda, McMaster generally sought to curate the opinions of the relevant administration officials and present a range of options to Trump. "Sometimes you have very forceful differences of opinion among the president's senior advisors," Senator Tom Cotton, a McMaster ally, said at the time. "HR is indispensable in helping the president hear all those viewpoints and have the information he needs, and framed in time for the president to make a decision." U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley added, "When we're in those meetings, he's all about getting options on the table for the president." Another episode startled Trump's advisors on the Asia trip. As the president and his entourage embarked on the journey, they stopped in Hawaii on November 3rd to break up the long flight and allow Air Force One to refuel. White House aides arranged for the president and first lady to make a somber pilgrimage so many of their predecessors had made, to visit Pearl Harbor and honor the 2,300 American sailors, soldiers, and Marines who lost their lives there. The first couple was set to take a private tour of the USS Arizona Memorial, which sits just off the coast of Honolulu and straddles the hull of the battleship that sank into the Pacific during the Japanese surprise bombing attack in 1941. As a passenger boat ferried the Trumps to the stark white memorial, the president pulled Kelly aside for a quiet consult. "Hey, John, what's this all about? What's this a tour of?" Trump asked his chief of staff. Kelly was momentarily stunned. Trump had heard the phrase Pearl Harbor and appeared to understand that he was visiting the scene of a historic battle, but he did not seem to know much else. Kelly explained to him that the stealth Japanese attack here had devastated the U.S. Pacific Fleet and prompted the country's entrance into World War II, eventually leading the United States to drop atom bombs on Japan. If Trump had learned about a date which will live in infamy in school, it hadn't really pierced his consciousness or stuck with him. "He was at times dangerously uninformed," said one senior former advisor. Trump's lack of basic historical knowledge surprised some foreign leaders as well. When he met with President Emmanuel Macron of France at the United Nations back in September 2017, Trump complimented him on the spectacular Bastille Day military parade they had attended together that summer in Paris. Trump said he did not realize until seeing the parade that France had had such a rich history of military conquest. He told Macron something along the lines of, "You know, I really didn't know, but the French have won a lot of battles. I didn't know." A senior European official observed, "He's totally ignorant of everything, but he doesn't care. He's not interested." Tillerson developed a polite and self-effacing way to manage the gaps in Trump's knowledge. If he saw the president was completely lost in the conversation with a foreign leader, other advisors noticed, the Secretary of State would step in to ask a question. As Tillerson lodged his question, he would reframe the topic by explaining some of the basics at issue, giving Trump a little time to think. Over time, the president developed a tell that he would use to get out of a sticky conversation in which a world leader mentioned a topic that was totally foreign or unrecognizable to him. He would turn to McMaster, Tillerson, or another advisor and say, "What do you think of it?" There was always the concern when no one was there that he would be maneuvered into a condition or an agreement that he didn't realize he had committed to, one former senior advisor said. They tell him to do something, and he does it. Oftentimes, after meetings with Trump, Kelly and Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis would huddle together, sometimes with McMaster in the National Security Advisor's office, sometimes without him, to compare notes on the presidential performance they had just witnessed. In words, and sometimes simply facial expressions, they communicated a shared concern. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. In the spring of 2017, as aides gathered in the Oval Office one day to brief Trump on upcoming meetings with foreign leaders, they made a passing reference to some foreign government officials who were under scrutiny for corruption, for taking bribes. Trump perked up at the mention of bribes and got rather agitated. He told Tillerson he wanted him to help him get rid of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. "It's just so unfair that American companies aren't allowed to pay bribes to get business overseas," Trump told the group. "We're going to change that." Looking at Tillerson, Trump said, "I need you to get rid of that law." As if the Secretary of State had the power to magically repeal an act of Congress. The business developer turned president was angry about the FCPA ostensibly because it restricted his industry buddies or his own company's executives from paying off foreign governments in faraway lands. Other aides in the room turned to Tillerson to gauge his reaction. Surprised at Trump's request, Tillerson first paused, then found his words. "Mr. President," he said, "I'm not the guy to do that." Tillerson explained the way laws work. He said the Justice Department should be consulted about a series of statutes that now made it a crime for American business people to give bribes to foreign officials or business leaders to get contracts or deals struck in other countries. Then, in a somber kind of Schoolhouse Rock episode that had become a regular feature of the Oval Office education of this president, Tillerson said that Congress would have to be involved in the repeal of the law. Trump didn't miss a beat. He was unmoved by Tillerson's explanations and turned to Stephen Miller, the White House's senior policy advisor, who had long before proved that he could be relied upon to dutifully execute almost all of the president's wishes. Stephen, I want you to draft an executive order and repeal that law, Trump decreed, evidently still unaware or unconvinced that he alone did not have the power to repeal the FCPA. Later, after the meeting broke up, Tillerson caught up with Miller in the hallway. Miller, who had championed many of the president's most unpopular plans, told Tillerson he had some skepticism that the EO idea would work, a rare moment of agreement between the two men. There was a sign of trouble in the Russia investigation after Trump returned from Asia. The lawyers for various witnesses and subjects in special counsel Robert Mueller's probe had been sharing information and strategies as part of a joint defense agreement. On November 22nd, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's lawyer, Robert Kellner, alerted Trump's attorneys that Flynn was withdrawing from the joint defense agreement and could no longer communicate confidentially with the president or the White House. Though Kellner did not explicitly say so on the call, John Dowd, Trump's lead personal attorney, took Flynn's withdrawal from the agreement as an indication that he had begun to cooperate with Mueller's office or was actively seeking to do so. In either case, Flynn's lawyers could have a duty to shut off communications with other defense teams. The night of November 22nd, Dowd left a voicemail for Kellner, saying he would not be surprised if Flynn had gone on to make a deal with the special counsel's office, but that if he had information that implicates the president, then we've got a national security issue. Dowd asked for a heads up for the sake of protecting all our interests, then reminded him of Trump's warm regard for Flynn. Remember what we've always said about the president and his feelings toward Flynn, and that still remains, Dowd said in closing. He sounded conciliatory, friendly even. It was a tricky situation. Flynn's lawyers were hoping they could eventually secure a presidential pardon for Flynn if he was charged or pleaded guilty to charges. The next day, Kellner returned Dowd's message and reiterated over the phone that he couldn't discuss anything with Dowd or any other attorneys for the president. Dowd's mood shifted dramatically. He grew incensed, warning Kellner that he took this as a sign of Flynn's hostility toward the president and that he planned to let President Trump know that. Kellner and his co-counsel Steve Anthony saw it for what it was. Dowd was indirectly threatening the wrath of Trump if they didn't change their plans to have Flynn cooperate. They also knew, as did Dowd, that Flynn didn't want to anger the president. The Flynn news came at a stressful time for Trump's attorneys. Since the summer, Dowd and White House lawyer Ty Cobb had persuaded Trump to buy into their strategy to cooperate fully with the investigation by assuring the president that if he did so, Mueller would have to wrap up the probe more quickly. Dowd first told Trump that Mueller's investigation into possible collusion with the Russians could be over within weeks or months, but that didn't pan out. Cobb had been telling reporters the White House portion of the probe could be complete by Thanksgiving, but that deadline slipped away, and he suggested instead the end of the year. Dowd felt growing pressure to satisfy his impatient client, but he had no control over delivering what Trump wanted, a public exoneration from Mueller. By now, the White House, the Trump Organization, and the Trump campaign had turned over the reams of documents and internal emails that Mueller had requested, and all the members of the White House staff Mueller had requested had either sat for interviews or scheduled them with the special counsel's office, with Don McGahn being the last on Mueller's list. They wondered now, What if Mueller wants to interview the president? That would be a natural request. Cobb said they couldn't reject the idea of an interview publicly. Dowd was wary, but thought an interview might give the old man what he wanted. Jay Sekulow, another Trump attorney, was cautious. One day after Thanksgiving, he called Mike Bowe, who also represented the president, to talk it over. "What do you think about an interview with the president?" Sekulow asked Bowe, who was working in his garage. After a brief pause, Bowe told him what he really thought. "It's legal malpractice." Having any client testify was risky, but the risks increased manyfold with a client like Trump, who tended to exaggerate and had his own brand of reality. Trump's lawyers had prepped CEOs for depositions for hundreds of hours and always carefully reminded them of the rules. If you couldn't remember key parts or every detail, simply say, "I can't recall." If you didn't know for certain, say, "I don't know." But such executives were bred to have answers and tended to be impossibly stubborn. It was as if they were genetically unable to say, "I'm not sure." Trump was an extreme version of this. His lawyers took note that Mueller's team had proved they would charge people for inconsistent accounts. The lawyers continued to game out the possibilities when the reason for the Flynn team's silence was revealed. The former national security advisor pleaded guilty on December 1st to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, the first White House aide to face charges in the probe. The guilty plea revealed that Flynn was cooperating with Mueller's team in their ongoing work and had shared with them his discussions with unnamed senior officials in Trump's transition. Though it was unclear what else he might have told the special counsel about the Trump campaign or administration, his cooperation indicated that Mueller's probe was heating up rather than cooling down and would likely continue for many more months. Trump was anxious and increasingly furious as he watched CNN coverage of Flynn's guilty plea that day. He called Steve Bannon, who was traveling in Scotland. "How can Flynn be charged?" the president said. "Flynn didn't do anything. Flynn's innocent." Trump said the whole scene made him angry. He said he was worried Flynn hadn't done anything wrong. "They targeted him because he worked for me," Trump lamented. Bannon seized this opportunity to share his view of Trump's lawyers and their strategy. Bannon had long been skeptical that Mueller would ever clear the president of wrongdoing so quickly, and believed Dowd and Cobb were effectively wearing rose-colored glasses and misleading their client. "You gotta get rid of Cobb and Dowd," Bannon told Trump. "They're walking you into a trap that's going to blow up. You gotta get real lawyers. You gotta get a law firm. You gotta hire Jones Day. They're the only law firm that will work with us. You need a ton of associates. You've got to exert executive privilege and not send any more documents and not produce any more witnesses." Bannon tried to play to Trump's pugilistic and litigious impulses. "You've got to fight this," he told the president. "You can stretch it out for a number of years." Trump replied that Dowd and Cobb had assured him that cooperating was the best strategy. "They tell me I'm going to get a letter of exoneration," Trump told Bannon. It was going to be over any day now. Trump was sure of it. Bannon shook his head at the notion that Mueller was about to give Trump a clean bill of health. On the morning of December 2nd, Trump was upset that none of his lawyers were speaking up for him in the media and pushing back against speculation that the reason Flynn lied to the FBI might have been to avoid implicating the president. At 12:14 p.m., about 24 hours after Flynn's plea agreement was entered in federal court, Trump took to Twitter to defend himself, as he often did, and in so doing offered a striking new view on Flynn's criminal acts. I had to fire General Flynn because he lied to the vice president and the FBI, Trump tweeted. He has pled guilty to those lies. It is a shame because his actions during the transition were lawful. There was nothing to hide. The tweet surprised and frustrated Cobb. This was explicitly what he thought he and Dowd had persuaded Trump not to do. Plus, the substance of the message created a whole new firestorm, indicating that Trump had long known Flynn had lied about his contacts with Kislyak, something the president had never before acknowledged. It covered the cable news stations all Saturday morning, and reporters were barraging the White House press shop for comment on this new development. Cobb confronted Dowd about the tweet. "Where did that come from?" Cobb asked his colleague. "This is contrary to everything we agreed to." "The old man asked me to," Dowd said, referring to the president. Dowd later challenged this account, claiming that Cobb had advanced notice of the tweet language. Dowd then issued a statement asserting that he had drafted the language for Trump's tweet. Meanwhile, Dowd and Sekulo were preparing for a meeting they had scheduled with Mueller in the third week of December. They were hopeful it would lead towards some closure, at least in terms of concluding the president and his campaign had not colluded. The president had been telling friends that the probe would be largely complete within weeks, and when that was reported in the Washington Post, his lawyers felt even greater pressure to somehow bring the investigation to an end. On December 6th, Beau flew to Washington to see Dowd. They met at Shelley's back room, a cigar bar 2 blocks from the White House. Beau was worried enough by what he was hearing to make a special trip. He wanted to make sure Dowd didn't agree to a presidential interview as a means of making good on his promise to Trump, in part because there was no guarantee that putting the president in front of Mueller would necessarily end the probe. "I'm sure this will be over soon," Dowd told Beau. "I'm confident we can get a letter." Beau feared Dowd would agree to an interview to try to end the probe. Dowd later said he had no intention of considering an interview. "It would just be malpractice, John," Beau replied, waving the red flag that he knew lawyers would pay attention to. "And there's no need. In order to try to get it done quickly, we shouldn't make a bad mistake." The lawyers were in a bind, with no clean bill of health on the horizon. Meanwhile, Trump continued to deny the conclusive evidence gathered by his own intelligence agencies that Russia waged an assault on American democracy by interfering in the 2016 election in support of his candidacy. Even as he proclaimed total innocence of conspiring with the Russians, Trump still couldn't bring himself to state definitively that the Russians interfered in the election. What the president has to say is, "We know the Russians did it. They know they did it. I know they did it. And we will not rest until we learn everything there is to know about how and do everything possible to prevent it from happening again." Michael Hayden, who served as CIA director under President George W. Bush, told Greg Miller of The Washington Post. Trump has never said anything close to that and will never say anything close to that. As the year came to a close, Trump and his administration did little to hold Russia to account for its illegal actions or to deter future Kremlin attacks and safeguard U.S. elections. The only punishment for Russia came from Congress, which voted in August to impose additional penalties against Moscow, despite fierce resistance from Trump. As Trump pursued an alliance with President Vladimir Putin, he never convened a cabinet-level meeting on Russian election interference in 2017. In December, Trump had gathered his generals and top diplomats for a meeting as part of the administration's ongoing strategy talks about troop deployments in Afghanistan in the Situation Room, a secure meeting room on the ground floor of the West Wing. Trump didn't like the Situation Room because he didn't think it had enough gravitas. It just wasn't impressive. But there Trump was, struggling to come up with a new Afghanistan policy and frustrated that so many U.S. forces were deployed in so many places around the world. The conversation began to tilt in the same direction as it had when Trump met with top military and national security officials in the Pentagon's tank back in July.
All these countries need to start paying us for the troops we are sending to their countries. We need to be making a profit, Trump said. We could turn a profit on this.
General Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, tried to explain to the president once again, gently, that troops deployed in these regions provided stability there, which helped make America safer. Another officer chimed in that charging other countries for U.S. soldiers would be against the law.
But it just wasn't working, one former Trump aide recalled. Nothing worked.
After the tank meeting in July, Tillerson had told his aides that he would never silently tolerate such demeaning talk from Trump about making money off the deployments of U.S. soldiers. Tillerson's father, at the age of 17, had committed to enlist in the Navy on his next birthday, wanting so much to serve his country in World War II. His great-uncle was a career officer in the Navy as well. Both men had been on his mind, Tillerson told aides, when Trump unleashed his tirade in the tank, and again when he repeated those points in the Situation Room in December.
We need to get our money back, Trump told the room.
That was it. Tillerson stood up. But when he did so, he turned his back to the president and faced the flag officers and the rest of the aides in the room. He didn't want a repeat of the scene in the tank.
I've never put on a uniform, but I know this, Tillerson said. Every person who has put on a uniform, the people in this room, they don't do it to make a buck. They did it for their country, to protect us. I want everyone to be clear about how much we as a country value their service.
Tillerson's rebuke made Trump angry. He got a little red in the face, but the president decided not to engage Tillerson at that moment. He would wait to take him on another day. Later that evening, after 8, Tillerson was working in his office at the State Department's Foggy Bottom headquarters, preparing for the next day. The phone rang. It was Dunford. The Joint Chiefs Chairman's voice was unsteady with emotion. Dunford had much earlier joked with Tillerson that in past administrations, the Secretaries of State and Defense Department leaders wouldn't be caught dead walking on the same side of the street, for their rivalry was that fierce. But now, as both men served Trump, they were brothers, joined against what they saw as disrespect for service members. Dunford thanked Tillerson for standing up for them in the Situation Room.
You took the body blows for us, Dunford said, punch after punch. Thank you. I will never forget it.
The fateful meeting between Dowd and Sekulow and Mueller finally came in late December. As Dowd asked what else was needed to wrap up this investigation that was hampering the presidency, Mueller gave them the answer for which they had been warily bracing.
Well, we're going to need to interview the president, Mueller said.
Then the special counsel clarified why. Mueller confirmed that he needed a presidential interview to finish a report he was writing about his investigation of Trump. The special counsel regulations described a report as the method by which Mueller could communicate his findings to the attorney general. But the lawyers had never heard Mueller mention it before. Dowd and Sekulow didn't say no to the interview. They asked more questions.
You've got to tell us what you want to interview him on, Dowd said.
At first, Mueller's deputies insisted they weren't going to provide questions, but later they agreed that James Quarles, one of Mueller's deputies, would relay some basic topics they would ask about. Dowd and Sekulow did not have a problem with the special counsel asking Trump about his connections with Russians or participation in any interference conspiracy during the campaign. They believed he had none. But they were wary of other interview topics, such as questions that would probe what Trump had said to former FBI Director James Comey about Flynn. Trump said flatly he didn't remember saying he had hoped Comey could let this go in discussing the investigation of Flynn, as Comey wrote in his contemporaneous notes. But a prosecutor could conclude that Comey had been honest and Trump had not. Those kinds of questions were perjury trap 101 for prosecutors. The meeting ended without an agreement about an interview. Dowd and Sekulow then briefed Trump on what Mueller and his team had said. The president was excited. He was raring to get in a room with Mueller.
"Will they agree it's over?" Trump asked his lawyers. "Do I get my letter now?"
"Well, they want an interview," Dowd said. Dowd explained how they might negotiate the terms of an interview.
"Great," Trump answered. "Let's do it."
Trump had an unyielding faith in his own abilities to persuade Mueller. "The president thought, I can do this. I can get this done," one of his advisors recalled. What Trump's lawyers viewed as a legal matter with some political fallout, the president saw as a political event with a legal component. He felt he was being bludgeoned in the media over all things Russia, persecuted in historic, even biblical proportions. Trump was adamant that the cloud be lifted by any means necessary, even if it meant taking control of the crisis himself. "Any other president would have said, do your thing and come to us when you are done," this advisor said. That was not President Trump. President Trump wanted it done now. You couldn't give him comfort by saying, we're going to deal with this the way we normally handle cases. He would say, that's a fucked up strategy. This isn't normal.